Thank you very much, David, and thank you everyone for coming along today. It's a real pleasure to be able to be here and be part of the macroeconomic conference. It's perhaps stating the obvious to say that a very important part of the macroeconomic environment is monetary policy. The actions of central banks have material effects on financial markets and they can shape macroeconomic outcomes. And indeed, over recent decades, it's become the accepted wisdom that monetary policy was the primary macroeconomic stabilisation tool and that monetary policy could effectively manage the business cycle. From today's perspective, though, I think the picture looks a little different. In many ways, the current global monetary environment is quite extraordinary. There's been unprecedented money creation by the world's central banks. Policy interest rates across much of Europe are negative. Long-term government bond yields in most advanced economies are the lowest on record. Lending rates for many private sector borrowers are the lowest ever. And quite a few banks in Europe are now actually charging customers to accept their deposits. Now, in earlier eras, one could have predicted, I think with some confidence, that this type of monetary stimulus would have caused a boom in economic activity and a subsequent lift in inflation. Yet today, in many parts of the world, there's considerable spare capacity, inflation rates are low almost everywhere, and inflation expectations have generally declined, not increased. So this afternoon, I'd like to talk a little about these very unusual times. I first want to show you some graphs to set out the basic facts, and then I'd like to explore some of the possible reasons why we find ourselves in this situation, and then conclude by addressing some of the implications of all this for Australia. So first of all, to the facts. Since the global financial crisis, as I said before, we've seen extraordinarily large increase in the size of central bank balance sheets. And this first graph shows you the picture. It shows you the combined balance sheet of the Federal Reserve, the Bank of Japan, and the European Central Bank. The combined balance sheet has increased from around $3.5 trillion US in early 2007 to almost $10 trillion today, and a further substantial increase is in prospect. Once this increase has occurred, the combined balance sheet of these three central banks will be equivalent to around 35% of the relevant country's GDP, and that's up from around 10% prior to the crisis. And this increase has occurred primarily by the central banks creating money to purchase assets from the private sector. This next graph shows a very long time series of nominal 10-year government bond yields. And the striking thing is how low these rates are now. The German and the Japanese governments can borrow for 10 years at less than 0.4 of 1%, and the US and UK governments can pay around 2% or less. And at shorter maturities, investors are prepared to actually pay governments to look after their money. And it's not just governments who can borrow at negative interest rates, with yields on some corporate bonds in Europe recently also turning negative. With these nominal rates so low, real long-term government bond yields are negative in much of the world. One way of calculating these real rates is to subtract the central bank's inflation target from the nominal 10-year yield, and you can see the results of that here. If the central banks do achieve their inflation targets, and there must be some doubt whether they will, but if they do, the current yields imply very large real losses for the holders of many sovereign bonds. If the Bank of Japan were to achieve its inflation target over the next 10 years, then the current holders of Japanese government bonds would lose around 15% of their money in real terms. The same is broadly true in Germany. These are very large losses if they occur. And the United States, the real return, if the Fed achieves its inflation target over the next 10 years, would be zero. This next graph shows the current headline inflation rates for a number of countries, as well as the midpoint of the inflation target. In all advanced economies, inflation is currently below target, and that's also true in many emerging market economies. Now, one reason for this is the recent decline, large decline in oil prices. But even if you look at core or underlying inflation rates, as shown in this next chart, most of those core or underlying inflation rates are also below target. So to briefly summarise here, the current environment in which is one in which there's been an extraordinarily large monetary stimulus. Interest rates are extraordinarily low, and yet inflation is subdued. And this is not exactly what the traditional textbooks would have predicted. So the obvious question that arises is, why do we find ourselves in this situation? And what does it say about the effectiveness of global monetary policy? Now, one answer is that the current environment simply reflects the extreme nature of the financial crisis, and that really monetary policy is working pretty much as it always has. So in quite a few dimensions, the crisis was the biggest financial shock since the Great Depression in the 1930s, led to major stresses in bank and government balance sheets, and it badly dented confidence. Monetary policy responded to this, and the size of the response was commensurate with the size of the shock. Now, according to this line of argument, what's unusual about the current environment is not the magnitude or the effectiveness of monetary policy, but rather the magnitude of the underlying problem to which monetary policy has responded. An alternative answer, though, is that the effects of monetary policy have been somewhat less, or at least slower to materialise than in earlier times. This line of argument recognises the considerable damage caused by the financial crisis, but sees economic activity and inflation responding in only a relatively muted fashion to the monetary stimulus, and as a result, the central banks have had to do more to achieve their mandated goals. Now, there's probably an element of truth in both of these answers. The shock caused by the financial crisis was indeed very large, and a very large monetary response was appropriate, and it's been helpful. At the same time, though, the transmission of monetary stimulus to the real economy does look to have been a little different through this episode. Economic activity does not appear to have responded in the way that occurred in the past. And as I spoke about a minute ago, inflation rates have been very low. Perhaps the single most important factor explaining this is the very high levels of debt that exist in many advanced economies. Now, one of the channels through which monetary policy works is by encouraging people to bring forward future spending to today. This requires them to borrow, or at least to reduce their savings. And in the years leading up to the crisis, a reduction in interest rates could be reliably predicted to encourage such a response. Credit was easily accessible, economic volatility in many countries was low, and people were prepared to borrow. In today's world, though, things look quite different. After a steady increase in debt levels over the previous two decades, which is very clear in this chart, many people do not want more debt. They do not want to, or at least they don't have the confidence to, bring forward future spending to today. And as a result, household indebtedness in many countries has declined, even though interest rates are the lowest on record. One area that where low interest rates do appear to be having the broadly expected effect is on asset prices. Global equity markets have been strong, property prices are again rising in a number of countries, and bond prices have increased very substantially. However, for these increases in asset prices to actually boost the real economy, households and businesses need to respond by increasing their own spending. While encouragingly in the United States there are some signs that this is now happening, on the whole, if you look around the world, the response of private spending to higher asset prices has been quite muted. I think overall, if you look at this whole experience, I do find it difficult to escape the conclusion the changes in interest rates are not affecting decisions about spending and saving in the way they might once have done. Undoubtedly, the low interest rates are helping repair balance sheets, as are the higher asset prices, and by doing so, they're laying the foundations for future growth in consumption and ultimately investment. But while this repair process is taking place, consumption is weaker than it otherwise would be. In turn, the subdued consumption is feeding through to a subdued business and climate, and thus weaker investment. I think it's also possible to argue that a similar dynamic is being playing out in government finances in quite a few countries. After the financial crisis, many governments found themselves with debt levels that were very high. And like many households around the world, they responded to this by tightening their belts. Given the high levels of debt and the ongoing imbalances between recurrent revenue and expenditure, very few governments have seen the extraordinarily low interest rates as an opportunity to support long-term infrastructure investment at very low cost. Rather, just as many households have done, governments have taken advantage of the lower interest rates to help shore up their own finances. Now, a second part of the transmission mechanism that looks a little different from the past is the flow on from economic activity to inflation. And the evidence here is less clear-cut. But looking around the world, it seems probable to me that both workers and firms perceive that their pricing power has declined. To the extent that this has occurred, it's likely to come from a combination of the scarring experience of the financial crisis and the increasing globalization of many markets. Again, looking around the world, wage outcomes have been remarkably subdued in many countries over recent years. That's not just true in countries with high unemployment rates, but also in those with low unemployment rates. In Germany, the unemployment rate is the lowest in more than 30 years. In Japan, it's the lowest in around two decades. Yet in both countries, wage outcomes are subdued. More broadly, if you look across a whole range of countries, wage increases over the last year or so have been slower than suggested by the standard Phillips curve relationships. Now, time will tell whether this is just a change in the normal lags, but I suspect there is something deeper going on here. The experience of the financial crisis has left deep scars in many economies, including a heightened sense of job insecurity. This insecurity is being compounded by the increased competition that globalisation has brought, as well as by changes in technology. It's led to many workers in advanced economies feeling less inclined to seek the wage increases that they might once have sought. They feel they have less market power, and thus keeping a job is more important than seeking a large pay increase. I think a similar dynamic is also playing out in the pricing decisions of many firms. Globalisation has brought new competition, and the financial crisis increased uncertainty. In this environment, putting up prices can look like a more risky proposition than it did previously. Again, it's difficult to tell how persistent any of these perceived changes in market power are likely to be. I think it still seems probable that a period of strong growth in the global economy would eventually see a generalised increase in pricing power. In the meantime, though, the inflation pressures in the global economy are quite muted, and the recent fall in oil prices has reinforced this and contributed to the decline in inflation expectations in quite a few countries. In this environment, the limits of monetary policy are becoming more visible than perhaps they were in earlier years. High levels of debt and increased uncertainty look to have changed or at least temporarily altered the transmission mechanism. And this is one of the reasons why the G20 and others have focused so much on the importance of structural reform and improving the climate for investment. At the global level, stronger and more effective policies in these areas would be helpful, encouraging both households and businesses to actually take advantage of the opportunities that low interest rates have provided. Monetary policy can help support this process, but ultimately, It can't be the fundamental driver of economic growth. So what does all this mean for us here in Australia? And there are three broad points that I'd like to make. The first is that the global monetary developments are having a significant effect on the configuration of Australian exchange rates and interest rates, and thus on our asset prices. The monetary stimulus abroad has tended to put downward pressure on the value of the currencies concerned. Conversely, it's put upward pressure on the value of other currencies where the need for monetary stimulus has been less, and that would include the Australian dollar. While movements in our own currency remain heavily influenced by changes in commodity prices, the upward pressure on the Australian dollar from developments abroad has complicated our transition in the economy following the mining investment boom. With the exchange rate higher than it otherwise would have been, domestic demand has been a bit weaker than it otherwise would have been. The board of the Reserve Bank has responded to this weaker outlook by having interest rates lower than otherwise. And this easier monetary policy has supported our own economy. It's done this partly by offsetting some of the upward pressure on our currency from developments abroad, although the scale of the global monetary stimulus means that our exchange rate remains relatively high given the state of our overall economy. The end result of these global developments is that we've been left with a higher exchange rate and lower interest rates than would otherwise have been the case. And we may not particularly like this configuration, but the developments abroad really give us little choice. I think, as you can see from this next chart, the lower interest rates have boosted our domestic asset prices, with both property and equity prices recording strong gains over recent times. The lower interest rates globally have also worked to push up our own asset prices. Overseas investors faced with very low returns have looked elsewhere around the world for higher yielding assets, and they found some of those assets in Australia, and so we've seen significant inflows into some types of investment. One good example of this is commercial property, where foreign investors have been attracted by the high yields on offer here. These higher asset prices are helping support our economy, although they do need to be watched carefully, particularly where they're accompanied by higher borrowing. The second general point that I'd like to make is that the same factors that are affecting the global monetary transmission mechanism are also evident in Australia, although my judgment is that they're to a lesser extent. Like households in a number of other countries, Australian households increased their borrowing over the decade or so to the mid-2000s as they adjusted to lower nominal interest rates and greater access to finance. And as you can see in this chart, over this period, the saving rate fell and indebtedness increased. But this adjustment in balance sheets is now complete. Over recent years, many more households have focused on paying down their debts rather than borrowing more, and the saving rate has risen, as you can see. In the earlier period, the level of interest rates that we have today would have caused a very large boom in borrowing, but this has not occurred in this episode. Now, one area where the change in behaviour is apparent is in the household sector's injection of equity into the housing stock, and you can see that in the bottom panel of this chart. In the early 2000s, when property prices were increasing very strongly, many households used their newfound wealth to withdraw equity and enjoy higher levels of consumption. Again, this is not occurring on this occasion, and this is changing the way that monetary policy affects our economy. A related part of the transmission mechanism that may be changing is the so-called cash flow channel. One of the ways that lower interest rates helps is by helps boost spending is by improving the overall cash flow of the household sector. Since household borrowing exceeds household deposits, a cut in interest rates puts more money into the aggregate household budget. But there are large differences across households. When interest rates go down, borrowers pay less interest, and so they're better off. But savers receive less interest income, and so they're worse off. And how these two groups respond to changes in interest rates determines how powerful this cash flow channel is. Well, I don't think it's yet possible to be definitive. I think there are reasonable grounds to believe that the behaviour of both borrowers and savers might have changed a bit over recent times. Many borrowers have responded to the lower interest rates, not by increasing their spending, but paying off their loan a little faster. And you can get a hint of this in this next chart, which shows the data on total mortgage repayments and total scheduled repayments. Conversely, it seems likely that those relying on interest income have reduced their spending by more than would previously have been the case. If the many letters that the bank has recently been receiving is any guide, this certainly would be the situation. Unfortunately, one of the consequences of a world in which many more people want to save than to invest is that the return to saving falls, particularly on savings held in low-risk assets like bank deposits. One other change in the global monetary transmission mechanism that has echoes in Australia is the behaviour of wages. Like in many other countries, wage growth in Australia has been quite subdued recently, and it's lower than would be suggested by most of our standard models that we use. As you can see from this chart, the latest reading of the wage price index shows an annual increase of 2.5%, and the earnings per hour measure from the national accounts, which were released yesterday, is lower still. I think increased job uncertainty is likely to be one of the factors at play here, with the various consumer surveys showing quite high levels of concern about future unemployment. The third and final general point that I'd like to make is that despite the transmission mechanism looking somewhat different, monetary policy in Australia is still working and it's helping support our economy. The area where this is perhaps most obvious is in housing construction, where there's been a very substantial lift. This part of the transmission mechanism appears to be operating pretty much as normal, with the increase in activity over the past 1.5 years being very closely in line with our internal forecasts that were made in the second half of 2013 when the cash rate was first set at 2.5%. And this increased activity in the housing market is boosting employment in the sector, and you can see the flow-through effects in spending on homewares and some related items. The exchange rate channel of monetary policy is also working, and there are now some signs that the depreciation of the Australian dollar is boosting domestic activity. Perhaps the clearest sign there is a substantial rise in the net exports of services recently. But also in our extensive liaison program with business, many businesses have recently reported that lower exchange rate is opening up new opportunities, and I'm confident that in time we'll see the effects of this in both domestic production and spending. Monetary policy, of course, is also working through the other channels that I discussed earlier, even if the impacts are somewhat less. So overall, monetary policy is continuing to play an important role in supporting demand in the Australian economy. At its February meeting, the board decided that it was appropriate to provide some additional support. This wasn't because things had turned for the worse, but rather because of a lack of compelling signs that economic growth was picking up, as we had earlier expected. And I think no doubt that the factors that I've spoken about this afternoon go some way to explaining why this might be the case. And it's meeting on Tuesday this week. The board maintained the cash rate at 2.25%, but noted that further easing may be appropriate over the period ahead. Finally, if we step back from the short term, the lower interest rates we are seeing globally and in Australia are a direct consequence of an elevated appetite for saving and a muted appetite for real investment in many countries. Monetary policy has responded to this reality in a way that a decade ago would have hardly seemed imaginable. And in doing so, it has helped the global economy through a very difficult period. But at the end of the day, the solution to the problems caused by the disconnect between the desire to save and the desire to invest cannot and do not lie with monetary policy. Instead, the solutions must lie in measures to improve the investment environment so that once again there is a strong and productive demand for the use of our society's savings. Thank you very much for your patience, and I look forward to any questions that you might have. Thank you.
Deputy Governor, thank you very much. First question, how close are we to the point where the cash rate reductions are ineffective in stimulating demand, and what options remain for the RBA in the event of another crisis?
There's a lot there. As I've tried to outline here, our judgment is that monetary policy is still working and still effective. It's working, as I said, you can see it clearly in the residential construction sector. It's having an effect on the exchange rate. It's having an effect on asset prices, and at the margin, I think it is helping boost consumption as well. So I don't think we're at the point where we'd conclude that monetary policy is not effective in supporting the economy. I think we're some way from that, which means that we do have scope to lower interest rates if we deem that that's appropriate.
What do you think is now fair value for the Australian dollar? I'm just reading the question.
It might surprise you that I'm not going to answer that with a number. We're much, much closer to it than we were any time over the past couple of years. I mean, remember, against the US dollar, we've come down, nearly 30 cents since its peak. So that's a very large adjustment. And it, as I said in my remarks, I think we can now see the effect of that on the economy. It's still, I suspect, too high for where it needs to be given the overall state of the economy, but it's certainly a lot closer to whatever the right number is than it has been for the past 3 or 4 years.
I guess in the same vein, in terms of trade shock, is best mitigated via currency adjustment. How does the RBA plan to foster a further fall in the A-dollar when so many other central banks are addressing their own demand shortfalls by pursuing policy that encourages weaker currencies?
Mm. Our intention has not been to foster a decline in the currency. And I think this is actually quite an important point. And many of my colleagues in other central banks have made the same point. What many central banks are doing are responding to weak domestic activity and subdued prospects for growth. And the way that you respond to that is to ease monetary policy. One consequence of that is having a weaker currency than would otherwise have been the case. So many central banks have responded with easy monetary policy and put downward pressure on the currency, but they have not responded to get their currency lower. It's part of the transmission mechanism. And so our intention is not to get the currency lower. Our intention is to set the right level of monetary policy so that the economy grows on a sustainable basis and that inflation averages 2.5%. That's our objective. That's what we're trying to do. As I said in my remarks, I think where we are now is the currency is higher than it otherwise would have been because of the global monetary developments, and we've got lower interest rates in response to that, and arguably would be better if that configuration was slightly different. But I think it's a mistake to think what we've been trying to do is to have an objective of getting the currency lower. Our objective is strong growth of the domestic economy consistent with the inflation target.
Thank you. What tools on the macroprudential side would be most impactful to keep house prices in check?
Well, I think we have to be realistic here. You know, the main objective, I think, of the macroprudential instruments, if you want to call them that, is to stop the current trends from accelerating, and so we don't get into a cycle of ever-rising prices, ever-rising borrowing, to decline in lending standards. And I think what APRA has done there is very sensible. It's consistent with its approach to supervision rather than regulation. It's basically trying to short-circuit or reduce the possibility of one of these kind of cycles of declining lending standards and higher property prices developing. I think we've got to give some time for that to work its way through. I think it's too early to tell what effect it's going to have. And APRA is looking very, I know it's looking very carefully at the lending portfolios of a number of institutions that are growing very quickly, and it's entirely appropriate that it does that. Well, I think what other countries have found in this general area is you have a kind of one round of this, and then the system's very good at finding ways of getting money to the people who actually want to borrow. And in a sense, it shouldn't be that surprising, because we went through this in the 1970s. All the macroprudential instruments that are now in fashion, we had those in the 70s. We used to call it financial regulation, but we had most of them. And ultimately, they turned out not to be that successful, and the system was liberalised. So the lesson that I take really from that is that these measures can work for a while. They can help. And I think what APRA has done now will help at the margin. But we can't rely on these type of measures to control housing prices or ultimately control aggregate borrowing in the economy. If you want to control housing prices, you've got to address supply, land supply and transport infrastructure. It's not APRA tinkering around with prudential instruments.
Should governments, I'm not sure how you're going to go, with governments with AAA credit ratings be taking advantage of that by borrowing more to spend on infrastructure, particularly transport?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. I think this is one of the reasons why being very disciplined on recurrent expenditure is incredibly important. If the budget is in such a situation that recurrent expenditure and revenue are in close alignment, and you expect them to stay in close alignment, I think that does open up opportunities in the government balance sheet. The issue that many, many countries face at the moment is recurrent expenditure is greater than revenue. And so that part of the budget is not in alignment, and I think you could make that point here. And one of the reasons why it would be better globally to have those two things, recurrent expenditure and revenue in alignment, is that it would open up the possibility to use the government balance sheet to help support in whatever way it could infrastructure spending. After all, as I said in my remarks, governments around the world can borrow at negative, zero or negative rates for 10 years. There must be many investments in our societies that earn positive rates of return. So there is, for an institution, a government entity with a strong balance sheet, there is the possibility to use that balance sheet to take advantage of those possibilities to improve infrastructure or whatever other capital works you think are appropriate. But I think you can only do that if the recurrent budget is in a sound shape. And as the governor has said, here, at the trajectory we're on, probably isn't the right one there. And that if you're on the wrong trajectory on the recurrent expenditure with respect to recurrent revenue, you don't have the same options to take advantage of low interest rates that a different fiscal setting would allow.
Do the post-GFC experiences around the world suggest that inflation targets have been set too low?
Well, my answer to that is no. And I'm thinking, what would be the logic to draw to where, how would lead you to that conclusion? No, I don't. You know, the important thing with the inflation targets is they anchor the community's inflation expectations and provide a sensible and sound way for the central bank to communicate with the public and with financial markets. So I think, and they've done that successfully. I don't know why having an inflation target of 5% would make this process any more effective. But I'd be interested if someone wanted to make the case.
Immigration to Australia appears to have weakened notably over the past year. How does this affect the economy and policy?
Well, I mean, it's slowed down a little, but I mean, we've got to remember that our population growth is very strong. I mean, you look at the population projections, the official population projections, and it looks highly probable that we will continue to have the fastest growing population in the OECD. if the current projections are correct, then in 5 years' time, I think we'll have nearly 10% more people living in this country, even with this current. So that's a position that no other Western country is in. And this is one of the reasons that I kind of remain fundamentally positive about our prospects, because this steady growth in the population opens up new opportunities for business. And we'll have 10%, in 5 years' time, we'll have 10% more people who need to live somewhere, work somewhere, play somewhere. The other aspect of, you know, this is a related issue, is with our demographics. Our population is incredibly internationalised. You know, 40% of people who live in this country were either born overseas or have a parent who was born overseas. Again, no other Western country has a number like that. And many of those people were born in Asia or had their parents were born in Asia. So that there are tremendous connections between the Australian population and countries abroad, and that opens up a whole set of business possibilities. So we've got a rapidly growing population, an internationalised population. I think that's we shouldn't forget that, because I think it's one of our fundamental strengths.